This is Meme Book Club. We like to read New York Times bestsellers that we think shouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. And we try to figure out why they were so popular and also so bad. Books that we have coming up: Bird Box by Josh Malerman, The Born Identity by Robert Ludlum, Whole 30 by Melissa and Dallas Hartwig.
Don't you dare call it a diet book.
Can I say one, Sarah?
If you want to.
The President is Missing by James Patterson.
And
Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Actually, Bill Clinton's up front.
A reason we don't let you say them, Claire.
The Art of the Deal by Donald J. Trump.
Hey, and that's our live show.
Maybe he'll come.
Tell your friends, get them reading the books.
Bye.
Love you.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Losing a parent is never easy. Losing one when you're still a child is devastating. It changes the course of your life. When the loss is due to illness or even an accident, it is possible to gain some measure of peace within the grieving process. It will always be painful. You will always miss your parent. But despite your grief, you can learn to move on. For the children of murder victims, there often is no peace. There is no closure. Even when there is justice, when the system works, families are irreparably shattered. Imagine how much worse the grieving process is when there is no justice. Cold cases are heartbreaking. The unknown is a wound that won't close. But what if you had an answer? There was an arrest, but the system failed you. For three sisters in Corpus Christi, Texas, their father and stepmother's brutal murders remain technically unsolved. The only man who has ever charged, a supposed friend of their father's and a former policeman, walks free to this day. No other person of interest was ever named, and the investigation came to a standstill almost immediately after the charges were dropped. Gary and Stephanie Gillette were bludgeoned with a hatchet and stabbed to death in their own bed. They deserve justice, their daughters deserve peace, and their killer deserves a reckoning. Welcome to episode 41, The Unresolved Slayings of Gary and Stephanie Gillette. Corpus Christi is a coastal city in southern Texas on the Gulf of Mexico. It's the largest city on the Texas coast and the sixth largest port in the nation. It was discovered by Spanish explorer Alonso Alvarez de Pineda on the Roman Catholic feast day of Corpus Christi in 1519. The bay, then the city that grew around it, took the Latin name of the feast day, Corpus Christi, which means the body of Christ. Corpus Christi is ethnically and culturally diverse. You're just as likely to run into a surfer as a cowboy. And the economy is largely driven by oil and tourism. The nickname, the Sparkling City by the Sea, is prevalent on tourist sites, but it is a well-earned moniker for the gorgeous city on the bay. It is also home to the NAS Corpus Christi, a naval air station that began flight training in the 1940s. Today, the Naval Aviator Training Program at NAS graduates more than 400 aviators each year. The USS Lexington, a World War II-era aircraft carrier turned naval museum, along with the Texas State Aquarium, Padre Island, and Mustang Island State Park are all popular tourist attractions, along with the gorgeous beaches and numerous food, music, and arts festivals the city is home to. In 1985, the city was a boomtown for the oil business, and 34-year-old Gary Gillette was a partner in a business called Aquavert Drilling Fluids, which sold drilling mud used as a lubricant and cooling agent for drill bits. Gary was the face of the company, and the role fit the genial, charismatic man perfectly. Born in December of 1951, Gary had been raised in San Angelo with two brothers and a sister. He moved to Corpus Christi at a young age to live with his father, but later, when his dad moved to South America for work, Gary managed to stay in Corpus Christi. He had met and fallen in love with a girl named Debbie Spears and moved in with her family. Gary and Debbie married and had three daughters, Shay, Christy, and Candace. By 1980, the couple had divorced, though by all accounts it was amicable and the two remained friends. Gary met and married a woman 10 years younger than him named Stephanie Smith. Stephanie was brought up in the tiny town of Richland Springs with two siblings of her own and was known to be a happy, cheerful, selfless, and beautiful woman. Gary and Stephanie Gillette were well matched. Both were witty and gregarious, attractive and outgoing. Stephanie was more than just supportive of Gary's business. She was an asset, often traveling with him on business trips and joining him for drinks with clients. They were married at the home of friends Jean and Tina Bowman in February of 1983. Jean was also Gary's business partner, and the couples got on great together. And Gary's three daughters loved Stephanie. They say she was an amazing person, a fun and caring stepmother who wasn't overbearing, but also wasn't a pushover. Gary's work could call him away at a moment's notice to wherever a client needed him, and Stephanie easily picked up the slack. She didn't mind. She loved the girls and treated them as her own. And she would have liked to have had kids of her own someday, but her life was tragically cut short less than 2 weeks before Christmas in 1985. On Friday, December 13th, Gary Gillette called his ex-wife Debbie and let her know that he would be late getting the girls. He was supposed to pick him up that night for the weekend, but he had a Christmas work party he really needed to attend, and he promised he would pick the girls up the next morning instead. Gary and Stephanie had bought their Christmas tree, and the girls were looking forward to spending time with their dad and Stephanie and trimming the tree. Gary had a prized 1970 convertible Buick Electra that he sometimes took the girls out in to see the Christmas lights if the weather was nice. But Saturday morning came, and the girls called their dad and got a busy signal. This was unusual. If he wasn't home, the phone would have just rang, not given a busy signal. Gary also faithfully used an answering service, and when Shay, his oldest daughter, called the service, they said they hadn't heard from him since 12:30 a.m. So that would have been late Friday night, early Saturday morning, after the Christmas party. Shay, at 14, had been a little at odds with her dad, which is not unusual for a girl that age. She may not have seen him as often as she used to, but he was still her dad. And that Friday, she had a bad feeling about her dad and Stephanie. It just was not like him to not show up without calling and to not answer his phone. Her sisters, Christy, age 11, and 8-year-old Candace, were disappointed at first, but they were also becoming worried. Gary Gillette was a dad you could depend on, and if he was working, Stephanie would have always called them back without fail. Shay got a friend to drive her by her dad's house that Saturday night. She saw that the garage door was open, which was strange, and the Buick was missing. Her dad's company car was pulled up to the curb next to the driveway, not in the driveway. It was an odd place for him to have parked, as if someone was blocking his way into the drive. Shay got out and walked around the house, looking in windows, but didn't see anything. She did notice that every light in the house was burning and thought it was more than strange. Her dad was not wasteful and would never leave lights on like that. It was simply a matter of luck that Shay couldn't see inside the window of her dad and Stephanie's bedroom. They had sheer curtains, but perhaps due to the glare of all the lights being on against the darkness outside, she just couldn't see anything. Which was a blessing, as her father and stepmother lay dead on the floor of their bedroom. They had been attacked with a hatchet and knife, and the scene was horrific. Shay would see photographs of it when she was older that would haunt her for the rest of her life. I'm going to pause now for a quick commercial break. Is there something bothering you? Are you feeling stressed or overwhelmed? We all need someone to talk to sometimes. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you whenever you're ready. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, trauma, grief, and many other issues that affect us all. You can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video. Anything you share is confidential, and if you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time with no additional charges. It's secure, convenient, and affordable. There is even financial aid for those who qualify. Why not get started today? Southern Fried listeners get 10% off your first month with discount code Southern. Go to betterhelp.com/southern and fill out the questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/southern. When Shay Gillette told her mother Debbie about how odd she felt at her dad's house, Debbie reminded her that her dad was a grown-up. Things happen. She said if they hadn't heard from him by the next morning, they would call her uncle or they would go over there. Shay had left a note on her father's car letting him know she had been there at 9:30 Saturday evening and to please call when he got home. All they could do now was wait. By Sunday morning, the girls were panicked, and Debbie called Mike Gillette, Gary's brother, to see if he had heard from them. He said no, and as he wasn't local, asked if Debbie would drive over to their house. Debbie and Shay drove over to the Gillette home on the 4800 block of Sweetbriar Circle. As they drove into the neighborhood, they passed several cop cars with their lights flashing. The sense of foreboding that had been coming over Shay all weekend intensified. She knew. The night before, as she drove away from her father's home, she had a vision of a murder scene. It wasn't specific. It wasn't even her dad or his house, just a terrifying flash of blood and gore. Now, as she and her mom pulled into the cul-de-sac where her dad's house was, she saw a coroner's van backed into the driveway. She saw more police, EMS, and bystanders, and she saw news vans were already on scene. Word was spreading quickly about the double murder. Shay ran to the house, headed for the garage door, and was physically stopped by police officers. She begged them to let her go inside, but they said they couldn't. Her father and Stephanie were dead, and she could not go into the house. It was now a crime scene. The news cameras caught Shay and Debbie falling to their knees upon hearing the news. How did the police and everyone beat them to the scene? As far as Debbie and the girls knew, they and Gary's brother were the only ones concerned about Gary and Stephanie Gillette. It turns out a friend of Gary Gillette's had called the police that morning, claiming he hadn't been able to get in touch with Gary all day Saturday or that night, and he was worried about his friend. He also happened to be a police officer himself. He was a constable with the Nueces County Sheriff's Department, which is basically a patrolman. Lowest on the totem pole and starting out as part-time, Gary Harris wasn't a full-fledged officer. But he had met the Corpus Christi police at the house and helped them to get in the door. The house had been locked up tight, and there is some confusion on how exactly he helped them into the house. There are rumors, which I won't repeat here due to this being an open case, but regardless, Gary Harris walked into the house at the same time the first police on scene did. The house was virtually spotless. The Gillettes were neat people, and unless you walked into their bedroom, you wouldn't know the home had been the scene of a violent crime. But in Gary and Stephanie's bedroom, the police found the couple lying in the floor. There was no question they were dead. Both had been viciously hacked in the head with a hatchet and stabbed with a butcher knife. Gary slept on his stomach, and he had been hit in the back of the head with a hatchet. Stephanie, a back sleeper, had been hit numerous times in the face and head. Both also had corresponding stab wounds. Gary's stab wounds were in his back, and Stephanie's were in the front to her torso. The wounds were from an ordinary chef's knife that had come from inside the house. So had the hatchet. They had been attacked while they were sleeping, never even having time to react. Gary was still in his green boxer shorts, and Stephanie was in white panties and socks. News reports at the time often mentioned the couple being partially clad, which adds a feeling of salaciousness to an already gruesome crime. But this wasn't a sex crime. The couple were attacked as they slept, wearing what they went to bed in that night. But their bodies had been moved. It was clear not only from the position of their wounds, but from the blood on the bed that they were attacked as they lay sleeping. Why the killer moved them to the floor is unknown. The initial search of the home was baffling. There were no signs of forced entry, and nothing in the house appeared to be disturbed. Gary had two gold rings that were missing, and Stephanie's purse was gone. But other than that, the only other thing missing was Gary's prized convertible Buick. The Buick usually sat in the garage. When the police arrived, the garage door was open, and the Buick was gone. Gary's company car was parked haphazardly at the curb, as though his driveway had been blocked. Whether he knew it or not, Gary Harris was an immediate suspect. He told the police he had been with the Gillettes the Friday night before, and he was the one to call the police out of concern for his friends when he couldn't get them to answer their phone on Saturday. It's actually quite common for suspects to insert themselves into investigations this way. Some killers get a thrill or a sense of superiority watching the police try to make sense of their crime. But I think in this case, Gary Harris knew it might be better for him to make the call. After all, he may have only been a constable, but he would have known that being the last person to see the victims alive would factor into the investigation. So instead, he got in front of it. But his story of Friday night and why he called the police would only add to the suspicion. First of all, Gary and Stephanie were an extremely social couple. They were close friends with Gary's business partners as well as other personal friends. And anyone who knew the couple knew the nature of Gary's job meant that the couple could often cancel plans at the last moment. Gary wasn't just the face of his company. He was a hard-working, hands-on type man. If a client had any problems or questions, Gary dropped what he was doing and went straight to the site. Those sites would be oil wells scattered all over southern Texas. And Gary and Stephanie did actually miss plans they had that weekend with friends. But those friends didn't feel the need to call the police or raise the alarm with Gary's family because they were used to the Gillette's hectic schedule. The only people that were really worried initially were Gary's daughters. Even his ex-wife chose to give him the benefit of the doubt and wait until Sunday. Why was Gary Harris so concerned that he couldn't reach the Gillettes? He has never given a good explanation for this. The Gillette sisters were understandable in their worry. Shay, Christy, and Candace knew their dad would answer their calls. And they knew Stephanie would have too. The last time Gary Gillette called his daughters and ex-wife, he explained that he had a work Christmas party he needed to attend. Again, as face of his company, these sorts of social events were part of his work. His ex-wife understood, and so did his daughters, even if they were a bit disappointed. That Friday night, December 13, 1985, Gary and Stephanie attended a Christmas party at the Tramp Steamer Bar, located in the Hilton Inn, just on the outskirts of Corpus Christi. They were having fun, but Gary needed to make an appearance at another Christmas party going on at the cantina. Gary asked a friend of his named Rodney to make sure that Stephanie was okay there by herself and to walk her to her car when she left. He then left for the cantina. He was driving his convertible Buick Electra, and he left the company car for Stephanie to drive home. They had taken two cars because he knew he had two parties to drop in on. According to Gary Harris, he and his date, a woman I will call Melanie, followed Gary back to the Gillette home. Harris had bumped into Gary at the cantina. The two had known each other since high school. The Gillette sisters have since called into question this so-called friendship. They said they had never laid eyes on the man, and they knew almost all of Gary's friends. But Debbie, Gary's ex-wife, did recognize Harris, though she only remembered him vaguely. And there is an article in one local paper that quotes C.P. Coker, another business partner in Aquavert, saying the two men were friends. He had nicknamed Gary Gillette Double G and claimed that he and the part-time deputy constable, Gary Harris, were all good friends. He said that the trio of friends got together at least once a week, and he was even quoted as saying that Gary Gillette had invited the two of them to Thanksgiving dinner at his house the month before the murders. I was able to confirm with Shay that her dad did have friends over that Thanksgiving, but she wasn't there and she didn't know who the friends were. I have a theory on why the girls didn't know Harris, and it could explain why Coker did know him as well. In the article, Coker mentions mainly hanging out in bars, pool rooms, and other parties with Gillette and Harris. This was the 1980s, and the bar scene in Corpus Christi catered to the oil business. It makes sense these men would socialize this way. But the 1980s ushered in a new era on the party scene and a new drug, cocaine. There is absolutely no evidence that Gary Gillette or Stephanie, for that matter, were drug users, but it's entirely possible they were around people who did use cocaine. In the 80s, cocaine was everywhere, but it was also considered more of an elite drug, a white-collar drug. Cocaine didn't have the same stigma it does today. It was a social drug, and if Gary Gillette was partying with clients and business partners, I think it's reasonable to believe he was around it. And if Gary Harris was a drug user and just a party friend, there's no way Gary Gillette would have introduced him to his daughters. It makes a lot of sense to me and explains why his business partner knew Gary Harris while his daughters didn't. But back to the timeline of the evening, Harris, his date, and Gary all went back to the Gillette home, presumably to have a few drinks and continue the party. At 12:30 a.m., Gary Gillette called his answering service to check his messages. Gary Harris came on the line after him. He did use the same answering service, so it wasn't that strange, except that he began asking about a woman named Rachel, This is a pseudonym to protect the real woman referenced by Gary Harris. And this part of the story is bizarre. Harris droned on and on to the answering service operator about this woman, Rachel, because he said he wanted to date her. He would make another call later to the service and do it again. It's an odd piece to the puzzle of this story. Before Gary Harris hung up with the answering service, he told him he would be spending the night at the Gillette home. There isn't much context to this information, but I would imagine it's because he was clearly inebriated and the operator may have been concerned that he would drive. Or it may just be that he used the same answering service, so he was letting them know he couldn't be reached at home. I think this would have been the more logical answer if it wasn't for his drunken rambling about this woman, Rachel. But the most important thing about this call to the answering service is it is the last time anyone other than Gary Harris spoke to Gary Gillette. It sets up a solid timeline for the murders, because at 3:45 a.m., Gary Harris called the answering service again. This time he called from his own home phone and promised the operator he would stay there, but only after again ranting about this woman, Rachel. His hyper-focus on this woman really sticks out in this story, but we will find another connection to her soon. Presumably, after this call, Gary Harris finally went to bed. According to Harris, when he woke up that Saturday, he tried to call the Gillettes numerous times. He never claimed that the line was busy, though, only that he couldn't reach him. The Gillette daughters were also trying to reach their dad and Stephanie and reported that the line was busy. This was the 1980s. Call waiting was already invented, but it's not clear whether the Gillettes had that feature. But typically, a busy signal indicated that someone was on the line or that the phone had been left off the hook. Newspapers would report that the phone line had been cut in the home, but this would not have created a busy signal either. Either way, the Gillette sisters and their mother were trying to reach Gary and Stephanie all day Saturday, and by Sunday morning, Debbie and Shay drove over there. As I explained earlier, they passed police and ambulances on the way to the house, and the home was already crawling with police, EMS, news reporters, and bystanders by the time they arrived. Gary Harris had called the police. Debbie recognized him, and he told them that he had called the cops out of concern when he couldn't reach the Gillettes by phone. Both Debbie and Shay said he reacted coldly to them at the scene. If he was such a good friend, it would seem like he would have been warmer to Gary's daughter. But he wasn't, and his strange behavior would continue over the next few days. As police continued to process the Gillette home for clues, the bodies of Stephanie and Gary were taken away by the coroner for autopsy. The police did not find much in the house to go on. The home had been locked up tight, and there was no forced entry. This indicated to investigators that the Gillettes knew their attacker. Also, both murder weapons came from the home. The knife was found cleaned and put back into the kitchen. It had an 8.5-inch blade, typical for a chef's knife. The other murder weapon was found in Shay's bedroom, across the hall from Gary and Stephanie's room. The hatchet, which had not been cleaned, was shoved between the mattress and box springs of Shay's bed. This is an important detail to keep in your back pocket. Police found the Christmas tree that the Gillettes were supposed to have decorated that weekend, standing ready in the living room. Police believe the hatchet had been laying nearby, that Gary had used it to trim the trunk of the tree, and also any long branches, before putting it into the tree stand. The hatchet appeared to be a weapon of opportunity or convenience, something the killer grabbed on his way into their bedroom. The bedroom was really the only room disturbed in the house. Gary and Stephanie were found on the floor, near the bed, but it was clear they were attacked as they were asleep in the bed. The bodies had been moved to the floor and possibly posed. At the coroner's office, the bodies were being examined for autopsy. Cause of death was found to be stabbing in addition to the blunt force trauma to their heads. I won't disclose the exact number and placement of wounds, again, because this is an open case, but I can say that Stephanie seemed to be the focus of the assault. She had more head wounds from the hatchet, and possibly, just because her wounds were to the front of her body, it appeared more vicious. There was a deep stab wound in Gary's back that caused internal bleeding in his lung, which indicates he was still alive when he was stabbed. From the location of the wounds, it would appear that the killer stood over the couple and attacked them at the same time. In a situation with two victims, a killer will normally dispatch the strongest, in this case the man, first. But considering that neither had time to react, it would seem that the killer hacked Gary in the back of the head and then quickly moved to Stephanie. Any of the wounds to their heads would have incapacitated them immediately. At some point during the attack, the killer went and got a kitchen knife to finish them off. It would seem like overkill, and while it definitely does seem like a frenzied attack, it also is important to note that victims don't always die right away from head wounds. Despite what you see in movies, humans are difficult to kill. As none of the stab wounds on Gary or Stephanie were post-mortem, meaning they were still breathing and their hearts were still pumping blood when they were stabbed, the killer may have grown panicked when the hatchet didn't immediately end their lives. When I say hatchet, you may be picturing a normal axe or even just a small hatchet, but this tool was actually a hammer hatchet, meaning it was half hatchet and half hammer. The blade of the hatchet was 4 inches, and the other side was the head of a hammer designed to drive in nails. Though Gary and Stephanie both suffered grievous injuries from the hatchet hammer, they clearly weren't dying fast enough for their killer. He went to the kitchen and picked up his next weapon of convenience, the knife. As Gary's stab wounds were to his back, we know that he was still lying in bed in the same position. Same for Stephanie. Her stab wounds were to the front of her torso. Despite what was later reported in the paper, Gary and Stephanie did not have any post-mortem wounds. After the autopsies, Gary and Stephanie Gillette's bodies were taken to the Cage Mills Funeral Home, and the funeral and burial services were scheduled for Wednesday, December 18, 1985. On Tuesday morning, Stephanie Gillette's parents arrived at the funeral home at around 9:30 a.m. They said that just a few minutes after they got there, Gary Harris arrived. They knew he had been the last one to see their daughter alive and asked him if he could shed any light on the murders. Gary Harris told him that he couldn't discuss the case with them as he was assisting the Corpus Christi police with the investigation. But J.D. Smith, Stephanie's father, did question Gary Harris again along with Mike Gillette, Gary Gillette's brother. He told the two men that he and his girlfriend Melanie had been at the Gillette home that night, hanging out with Gary when Stephanie came in later in the evening and picked a fight with her husband. He told J.D. and Mike that, quote, "we didn't have to put up with that, so they left." It is similar to what he told the police, but not exact. He did repeat another detail, though, and that was that his date had left her coat. After he and Melanie left the home, he returned and went back inside to retrieve her coat. He told police and relatives that he didn't see anything unusual when he went back. On Tuesday evening, the night before the funerals, a man called the police after reading about Gary's missing Buick Electra in the newspaper. He had seen the car on the 6200 block of Wimbledon Drive, just a couple of miles from the Gillette home. Police towed the car to impound and processed it. It had been wiped clean of fingerprints. Even Gary Gillette's prints weren't found. There was one print found on the car, though, and it belonged to Gary Harris. And the house the car was found in front of? It belonged to the parents of Rachel, the woman Gary Harris had been ranting about to his answering service the night of the murders. Upon questioning the family, police discovered that Rachel's brother had looked out the window and saw the Buick at around 2:30 a.m. that Saturday, 2 hours after Gary Gillette had called the answering service. This narrows the window for the murders to about 2 hours. This was too many coincidences, but the police still didn't move on Harris just yet. Gary and Stephanie Gillette were laid to rest in a cemetery in Portland, Texas, Wednesday, December 18th. Gary Harris was actually a pallbearer. At the funeral home, Harris kept up his bizarre diarrhea of the mouth. He asked Gary's brother, Larry, if he had seen his whiskey glass when he was in the Gillette home. Confused and probably offended at the insensitivity, Larry told him no. Harris apparently wanted to make sure he got his whiskey glass back. He also ran his mouth in front of another friend of the family, John Holsenbach. He claimed that Stephanie had lived several hours after the attack and that he had heard this from a family member who got it from the medical examiner, Dr. Joseph Rupp. Dr. Rupp assured police and the family concurred that he had never said such a thing. In fact, it was his opinion that both Gillettes died almost immediately. And then for 6 months, Gary and Stephanie's families and the entire community were on edge, in terror that a madman was on the loose. A crime as vicious as this one really shakes a community. At this point, Gary Harris's odd behavior wasn't widely known, though some friends and family did have suspicions. Finally, on May 30th, 1986, about 6 months after the murders, District Attorney Bill Mays and Sergeant Eddie Garza swore out a warrant for the arrest of Gary Harris. In an affidavit filed with the court, the details about Harris's calls to the answering service, the fingerprint and location of the Buick, and Harris's statements about Stephanie living hours after being attacked were all listed in the complaint. By Wednesday, June 4th, a grand jury was convened and Gary Harris was indicted on 2 counts of murder. He immediately hired legendary defense attorney Doug Tinker. Tinker was infamous in Texas for defending many high-profile murderers, including Yolanda Saldivar, who was famous for murdering Tejano pop singer Selena. By June 3rd, Tinker had already filed a writ of habeas corpus with the court, demanding Gary Harris's release. He claimed Gary was an upstanding citizen, a constable himself, and that his bail, which had been set at $100,000 for each count, was exorbitant. He promised letters of support from Gary's colleagues and also said that Gary had passed a polygraph. By Friday, June 6th, the judge reduced Harris's bail to just $20,000, $10,000 per each count, and he quickly made bail. And his buddies came through with the letters, including his supervisor. Constable Dwayne Matthews even spoke to the press, saying Harris had been treated unfairly and had already been tried in the papers and his reputation was ruined. Harris was suspended without pay for the investigation, and police turned up many interesting, though circumstantial, clues. Harris's original statement had many inconsistencies, especially when compared to what he was telling friends and family at the funerals and after. Harris called up Debbie, Gary's ex-wife, and asked her if she hated him. This was before his arrest, and startled, she said no, why? He didn't answer. But he again brought up the fact that he believed Stephanie lived for hours after the murders and told her because the killer had heard gurgling sounds and went back to finish her off. He claimed someone he knew close to the investigation told him this. No one is really sure why he kept insisting Stephanie died later. But this assertion Harris kept repeating was one of the main points in the affidavit for arrest that Sergeant Garza had pointed out. He said that only the killer would know that Stephanie lived after the attack. But the problem is, the coroner never told anyone this, because it wasn't true. Police weren't telling the family or anyone this either. But muddying the waters a bit, papers reported that the stab wounds on the Gillettes were post-mortem. This supported the theory that the killer did come back hours later and decided to mutilate the bodies further. It's interesting to note for a couple of reasons. Number one, it isn't true. Number two, Gary Harris made several statements to the effect that when he was seeing his date Melanie home in the wee hours that Saturday morning, he realized she had forgotten her coat and went back inside the house to retrieve it. Gary Harris's statement about Stephanie living longer fit into this notion of him going back in the house. If he was the killer and went back inside, maybe he did hear Stephanie gurgling for breath and grab the knife then. It's easy to see how the police would want to make this work, but it just doesn't fit. I think Gary Harris could not keep his damned mouth shut. He wasn't just trying to cover his tracks, he was enjoying the attention. And so he embellished. But as I've said on this show before, the best lies have a little bit of truth. After he attacked the Gillettes with a hatchet, he could have heard the noises from Stephanie or Gary, either as they were dying or the natural noises that occur shortly after death. It could, in fact, be the reason he went for the knife. But this detail he kept adding only made him look all the more guilty. Years later, the Gillette daughters would find out that Gary Harris's date that evening, Melanie, was actually hypnotized by the Texas Rangers to see if she could remember anything else. She had maintained that she and Gary Harris had gone to bed in Shay's room shortly after Stephanie came home. She said a couple of hours later, Harris woke her up telling her some bad shit was going down and they had to leave. In their haste, she did indeed forget her coat. But she also revealed that when she woke up, she didn't remember having sex, but felt as though she had. Her genitals were sore. She said Harris took her back to her car and told her she needed to follow him home, but she didn't. She took off and drove to her own home. It seems to me that Melanie was possibly the victim of a sexual assault. And the murder weapon, the hatchet, had been found under the mattress in the bed where she and Harris had gone to sleep. Police also found that Gary Harris was connected to drugs, specifically cocaine. But none of these findings were direct evidence. It was a completely circumstantial case, and in October of 1987, DA Bill Mays dropped the charges. He said that the investigation had not found proof that he felt a jury would convict on, proof beyond reasonable doubt. He means direct evidence. Some folks close to the case feel that the DA dropped the charges as he was intimidated by the high-powered defense attorney, Doug Tinker. And that is entirely possible. However, it's also possible that he was worried a judge could later drop the case because the investigation had drug on for so long that it had deprived Gary Harris of a speedy trial. At a press conference after the charges were dropped, Gary Harris said he was concentrating on getting his life back and had been promised there would still be a job for him, but that, quote, "I have lost a little faith in the judicial system because it seems a person is guilty until proven innocent." Well, he can bellyache all he wants, but I read the papers, and they were not overly harsh to Gary Harris. When Doug Tinker requested lower bail, it was immediately granted, and Harris had been free for the year and a half that he was under indictment. That is no small feat in a vicious double murder like this. Doug Tinker took it a step further and hinted that they knew who the real killer was, but he couldn't identify him because his suspicions were based on theories. He said, quote, "I'm convinced this is the end of the problems for Gary Harris." Unfortunately, he was right. Harris was never again brought up on charges, but tellingly, he also wasn't rehired by the Sheriff's Department in Nueces County or any other district. He has had an extremely spotty employment record ever since. There are many rumors surrounding this case, and most I can't repeat or won't because I don't believe they make any sense. In a tragic case such as this, those close often imagine intricate theories of the crime, and they often blame the police for shoddy investigations. The Gillette sisters have not made public comments about law enforcement. They have kept in touch over the years as different detectives have taken over the file, but nothing really changed. I think it's really important to note that no other suspect has ever been named or investigated. Two of the sisters, Christy and Candace, have run into Gary Harris in the years since he was dropped from the case. Both reported that he recognized them and that he immediately turned pale. He did not offer condolences or explain that he was indeed their father's friend and couldn't have committed these murders. Candace in particular was surprised he recognized her. She was 8 at the time of the murders, and she boldly questioned him directly, to which he stammered that he couldn't tell her anything or, quote, "I'll be next." Of all the rumors circulating about this case, how or why Gary Harris would have been killed next is not one of them. He's full of shit. But there is one rumor I find interesting, and that is that Gary Harris had some sort of fixation on Stephanie Gillette. Stephanie was a beautiful woman with many admirers, and several people close to the case have pointed out that both Gary's date that evening, Melanie, and the woman he rambled on about to the answering service, Rachel, both resembled Stephanie. I have not seen photos of these women myself, but more than one source I spoke with did see the resemblance. And while I won't dive into the many conspiracy theories, I will give one of my own. We know that Gary Harris was there that night. We know the police connected him to drug activity. We know from Harris himself and witnesses at the bar that Stephanie did arrive home later than her husband. We also know that Harris told Stephanie's father that when she got home, she and her husband began fighting. Supposedly, after this, they all went to bed. We know from Harris's date, Melanie, that after the two went to sleep, he suddenly woke her up, claiming something bad was going down, and then ushered her out of the house. Then we know he went home and made a point of calling the answering service again, this time making sure they knew he was at his house. I think this was an attempt to alibi himself. We also know that whoever did kill Stephanie and Gary attempted to make it look like a robbery. There wasn't much stolen from the house except Gary's Buick, which was then found parked in front of Rachel's house, the girl Gary Harris had been obsessed with so much that he ranted and raved about her to his answering service. I think Gary Harris was probably drunk and coked up that night. I think Stephanie Gillette did come home pissed to find her driveway blocked. Remember, the car she was driving was found parked oddly at the curb rather than in the driveway. She probably came in and was irritated to find her husband, Harris, and his date still partying and broke it up, sending everyone to bed. I think it's very possible that Gary Harris was fixated on her. Maybe it was sexual. Maybe he was just angry at whatever scene took place once Stephanie got back home. Because if his motive was sexual, he didn't act on it. Stephanie Gillette was not sexually assaulted. But after possibly having sex with his unconscious date, drunk and high and for some reason enraged, he walked through the house, grabbed the hatchet, crept into Gary and Stephanie's bedroom, and butchered the couple as they slept. And it is true that Stephanie seemed to receive the most rage. It was overkill on both of them, but Stephanie's attack seems more personal and rage-filled. He then took a few items from the house and drove Gary's prized Buick to Rachel's home, wiping it down with a cloth. He could easily have walked the 2.5 miles back to his car. Again, this is all speculation on my part. I have no proof of Gary Harris's guilt. But considering no other suspect was ever looked at, I think it's as good a theory as any. At the time of the murders, no direct evidence was found. Even Gary Harris's fingerprint on Gary Gillette's Buick could be explained as the two men were friends. Everything they had on Harris was circumstantial. And you can say the district attorney, Bill Mays, was intimidated by Doug Tinker, but he also would have been highly aware of double jeopardy, along with Harris's right to a speedy trial. He dropped the charges, hoping the police would turn up more evidence. You only get one bite at that apple. If he rolled the dice and took Harris to trial and lost, that would be it. The Gillette family would never see justice. And tragically, 34 years later, they still have no justice. Shay, Christy, and Candace Gillette are all now grown women with families of their own. They miss their dad and Stephanie, and they ache when they look at their own children and realize how much Gary and Stephanie have missed, and how much their own children have lost by not knowing their grandfather. Gary Gillette would also be a great-grandfather now if he had lived. If you have any information regarding the Gillette murders, please call the Corpus Christi Police Department at 361-886-2600. I hope someone out there does know something. Maybe you can finally bring peace to the Gillette family and the reckoning so deserved by this vicious killer. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. A very special thank you to Erica and Vince of the Gone Cold podcast for collaborating with me on this case, and also to Gary Gillette's daughters, Shay and Christy, for speaking with me, as well as Stephanie's cousin, Vaughn. The strength and grace of the Gillette daughters is inspiring, and I appreciate them speaking with me on such a painful subject. I hope the more this case is talked about, the closer we can get to justice. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. You can also listen directly from Spreaker, my network online, or on their app. And I'm also on Stitcher, as well as an awesome new podcast app called Himalaya. It's a brand new platform, and like you guys, I am always looking for a better way to manage all the awesome podcasts I listen to, and I really like Himalaya. If you're interested in supporting the show, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation. Or you could visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time only donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have a merchandise store open. Just go to whatamaneuver.net and click on Shop by Store. Then search for Southern Fried True Crime. I have all sorts of t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.